Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code Wondery for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/Wondery. Code Wondery.
There's a lot to say when buying a new home or car, but only one thing to say that can help you protect them. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. And just like that, a State Farm agent will be there to help you choose the coverage you need, no matter where you are in life. When you need coverage options, your State Farm agent is there to help, on the phone or in person. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Welcome to the Nerdist Podcast number 425.
Jesus Christ. Will we ever stop?
What are you, the AV Club? At Midnight is starting in just a couple days.
Oh, thank God we have some other creative outlet. It's amazing.
I hope people like it. The show's been really
they
fun
will
to do.
Like it. You know it's why been I like really, it?
I have to say, I've done a lot of shows. I've never been this involved in the process of the development of a show, and I absolutely love it. We have a phenomenal team of writers. You're on the team of writers working with Funny or Die and Tom Lennon and Ben Garant, and it's just been... It's been kind of a dream. And with that many executive producers, you would think there'd be a lot of fighting and tension. And we're all just on the same... We're all on the same wavelength, and the show's a blast.
The writers work 1 hour per day per executive producer. There are 12 executive producers.
That's how it works. But the show, a lot of people think that it's a talk show. It's not a talk show. It's essentially like it's sort of the soul of a British panel show. So it's like a game show. So there's a game show format where three comics come on,
Have I Got News for You. But instead of news, it's the internet.
It's social media and the internet and stuff, and so and interactive, and so you know it's on at Midnight after Colbert. We're gonna try it out for a month, and you know if people like it, then we'll do more next year. And
you should probably like it. I mean, that's just a recommendation.
If they don't, then back to the drawing board.
Oh God,
the drawing board that's almost eaten through with tears.
Yep.
We have to start over.
But unproduced things.
But this show has been absolutely a blast, and I would, you know, if someone said, hey, would you be happy doing the show every day for a long time, I would. So give it a shot, Monday at Midnight, Monday through Thursday after Colbert.
Yeah, I mean, DVR it. Watch it later if you have to. If you have to go to bed early, you know, watch us. And shut the fuck up. The Pete show is on at the same time. I know that. DVRs can record five things. So
I can hold up to five things.
Record both.
We'd like to thank Warby Parker for sponsoring this episode of the Nerdist Podcast. Warby Parker is the home try-on glasses program.
Never used it. How is it?
Matt, you can order five pairs of glasses that can be shipped directly to you for free.
This sounds like something I need.
Then you try them on.
Okay.
You get a feel for them. You get feedback from other people. Five pairs for 5 days. And then you mail them back to Warby Parker in a prepaid package, and then there you go, and then they'll fill out your prescription.
None of that bullshit of having to go to the store and deal with people.
No, I know you hate people, so you wouldn't have to do this with Warby Parker. They just send you the glasses to try on, and using the promo code Nerdist, when you buy a pair of glasses, you will receive free expedited 2-day air shipping. Normally you would get the glasses within 10 business days, but if you use the offer code Nerdist, then 2-day air shipping.
It's like Amazon Prime, but for glasses.
That's right. So I do want to specify that when you order five pairs of glasses, you do not get those in 2 days with the offer code Nerdist. You only get the 2-day expedited shipping when you actually purchase a pair of glasses. But then that's when you're going to need them.
Yeah, and that's when you're going to want them.
That's when you're going to want them.
Because the other four probably don't look great on your face.
That's right.
And that's not their fault. That's your fault. You have a weird face.
Because you have a weird face and kind of a lopsided head, and your eyes are too far apart. And the one you chose. Yeah, and then you have to bend the glasses so they fit your weirdly shaped, the bridge of your nose. And so
you get out of my head, Chris.
That's all right. I can't. I'm trapped.
So crazy.
It's a simplified process. Pick five frames, send back all five frames, order the final frame, use the promo code Nerdist, and then get your glasses expedited shipping within 2 days.
That's amazing.
WarbyParker.com. This episode of the podcast is Danny McBride and Jody Hill.
That was a great episode.
They were fucking great.
I can't imagine what that was like.
Danny McBride, who I found out didn't even have a comedy background. Like, you know, Danny and Jody were in film school together, essentially. Yeah. And then, but they, you know, they wrote and created Foot Fist Way and Eastbound and Down. And they're in their fourth season right now. It's Sundays on HBO at 10 p.m. So watch Eastbound and Down if you like to laugh and you like funny things. But they were... Yeah. But
I'm not on this episode, so it's probably going to move a lot smoother.
Somebody had to work.
Yep.
For At Midnight.
Yeah.
Thank you for your sacrifice.
Well, it's not really a sacrifice.
And thank you for listening to the Nerdist podcast that before. And thank you for listening to the Nerdist episode. God damn it.
Leave this in. It's gold.
425. It's iron sulfide.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Sorry, I'm a few minutes late. I went to the gym this morning.
Here we go.
And I, what do you go to the gym too?
Oh, no, I work out in a guy's apartment.
All right, so that's like a home gym.
No, it's really just an apartment.
Okay.
Bare light bulbs swinging above.
But, so that makes it cooler in some way?
I think so.
Oh, you fucking hipster. You gym hipster. So, I shower at the gym, I go in my bag, I'm like, I forgot to bring underwear. So I was commando for the first step. I had to go purchase underwear. So I just went to put it on.
Oh, nice. That's good. So you're wearing underwear for this interview.
Yeah, I am.
The only one.
Should I not? Wait, what? No, wait. I can take mine off. Does that make it cooler?
Easy, Chris.
No, shit.
Locked furnace basement.
Good thing I got the hardwood floors. Hey, did we... We did a thing at Tribeca, didn't we? I did not do a thing with you at Tribeca?
I don't think so. We didn't play Tribeca.
No, not you. I mean, not the movie.
I
thought I did something with someone.
Maybe
from...
David Green? Was that possible, David Green? Our other cohort?
I thought I did something with someone from Eastbound at Tribeca this year, like a one-on-one chat.
Oh, Will Ferrell.
It was not Will Ferrell and Will.
Jody gets mistaken.
I get that all the time. It's fine. Yeah.
So how long have you and Will been? I wanted to get you on for. So I'm sorry about the misunderstanding.
Oh, that's Will going to Tribeca with you if you want him.
Would you like to? I'm saying is, will you be my date to Tribeca?
Yeah, I would love that.
Is that weird? Great.
Thank you.
I ran into you like 2 years ago at C2E2 in Chicago, and I was like, I really want to get you on the podcast, and you're like, I know, it's been crazy.
You had a really small computer there. I remember it actually inspired me to go buy a MacBook Air after that.
That's what it was, yeah.
Operating off, you had like such a small little digital footprint. It was impressive.
Did you end up getting one?
I did get one.
Yeah. It's the best.
He's trying to sell me on it. Yeah.
Well, when you have the, I had the previous, just like the regular MacBook Pro, and you're like, oh, it's not that heavy. But then when you ditch it and you get the Air, then all of a sudden the other one feels like, why have I been carrying this cinder block in my backpack? Do you travel a lot?
I do, yeah. I try not to now. I have a 2-year-old son, so I don't try to travel as much as I used to, but I'm very anal about having everything as compact and small as it can be. Yeah. And yeah, so that fits perfectly into my obsessive personality.
Well, you can, you know, when you travel a lot, and then all of a sudden, when I travel a lot, all of a sudden, I was like, why am I having back problems all the time? And then I go to sling this giant backpack on.
You're just your iMac.
I've seen dudes like in Starbucks that bring their fucking iMacs.
It's not the craziest thing because it is just one piece. It's not like the guys I've seen with bring a tower.
No, but they do have to bring like a 24-inch fucking screen into a Starbucks, and
they're just playing like online games. That's I never see anyone getting like some real work done.
No, I feel like I always see audio editing. It's it's like for DJs and audio editors. They always
Starbucks.
Yeah, at the Starbucks.
That's where they sell good music there, so it's a real creative.
That's where
you got the new John Tesh, you got the new Eleni Mandel, you got the Decemberists, and you got some fucking weird compilation of jazz for white people.
Now the Decemberists are fine.
Yeah, sure. So was Eleni Mandel. So was all. John Tesh is great.
I mean, he did write
and the Monday Night Football. No, wait, some other fucking football theme he wrote. Anyone?
Sunday Night Football.
No. They're like the NFL theme.
Oh, you're NFL on football!
No. That was that racist guy.
Yeah. Hank Williams Jr.
Yeah. Shit. Never mind. What a fucking dead end that was.
Well, as soon as we start talking about sports on this podcast, it all goes south.
Yeah, this guy knew all about the Entertainment Tonight thing.
Well, because it was, you know, that was silly. So you guys weren't supposed to have a fourth season on Eastbound, and all of a sudden you had a fourth season on Eastbound. So how did that, when you wrapped up three, when you were like, well, I guess this is it. And they were like, no, more.
Why? Yeah. They basically just pulled a big truckload of money up to Jody's house.
Yeah.
And Jody was instantly, I'm on.
I was in.
Yeah.
After that, yeah.
It was just a coincidence.
I mean,
had nothing to do.
No,
that was
nothing.
Just when you had your creative epiphany, right?
Yeah, it was, well,
it was just,
I mean,
ironic that that would happen at the same time.
Honestly, that still hasn't happened. We just, you know.
I think it'll be coming shortly, right?
Yeah. I hope so.
I'm going to say the past two episodes of this new season have been like some of the tightest and funniest of the entire series.
Oh,
it's been great.
We were really apprehensive to do another season, you know, because we were creatively, we kind of felt like we were done with last season, but the only thing that we didn't kind of get to do last season was, like, our initial idea when we had the idea for the whole show was that, you know, he would get the love, you know, and in the third season it'd all be about him and his wife and kind of how shitty that would actually end up being if that were real. And like, when we got into the writing room, we were in the writing room for like a month on the third season, and then we got the call that we were only going to have Mixon for two episodes because she was on Mike and Molly. And so she was, like, in every episode that we were planning.
Oh, shit.
And so we kind of had to scramble and basically, like, threw away everything we were planning to do for the third season and just kind of came up with the concept that she ditches the kid with them. And that got her for two episodes, the first one, and then she returns at the last one.
Well, listen, it was literally like a Kramer versus Kramer model. We were just like, fuck, what do we do? Oh, Kramer versus Kramer, that works.
And the important thing is that it was worth it to help elevate Mike and Molly.
There you go.
So I think it really all worked out if you really think about it. Oh, we can't do this because you're going to do that? Yeah. Okay. Sure. I mean, but I think, you know, I think people probably know that your improv background is pretty insane. And so, like, it's funny to see that happen even in a writer's room with a story. Like, well,
here we go.
Yeah, when basically, you know, because of someone else, they go, freeze! Yeah. what's the occupation now? What's the scene now?
That was pretty much how it was. We all just sat around the river looking at all these outlines we had made, just like, idiots. What were we thinking we were going to be able to have her for? And we were kind of, because
that was about a month where we were like, we're fucked
because we were writing two productions, so we already were behind in our scripts. We always take a long time in the first episode of every season, and then we kind of have to really jam the last. So we had taken a really long time setting up this season that we were like, oh, this is everything we've always wanted.
I mean, that's where you
seriously
went wrong. You jinxed it.
The only thing that could go wrong is if someone said you couldn't show up. Yeah. But other than that, this is going to be the greatest television experience
we've
ever
had. She had to follow her artistic heart. Her cholesterol-filled heart.
An hipster.
What?
Still.
What?
Nothing. You're fine.
So you're defending Mike and Molly?
I'm not saying anything about it.
You're not saying anything bad about anything.
There's no reason to be shitty about things about people. There's no shittiness in the world.
I'm going to live and say that Eastbound Down is better than Mike and Molly. If you like Mike and Molly better than you like Eastbound Down, it's a weird time to say it.
Okay. How dare you turn my vanilla approach on pop culture against me? And make it a negative thing. Now I'm going to have this internal battle like, oh my god, I have to be nicer to the Eastbound guys so I have to shit on other things. Other people come on, I'm going to have to backtrack.
Who's on next week? Creator Mike and Molly. Fuck! Damn it!
That's always the way. So I was sitting with McBride and those guys who tried to dive bomb Mike and Molly. Sure glad that didn't happen. That'll be next week on the podcast. But don't you feel like there's enough negativity in the world?
Yeah, we don't want to hurt on anybody who's
just
doing this, you know, performing for people. It's right. Entertainment, right? It's such a silly occupation to begin with.
But I think that a lot of times when you're sort of shoved against the wall and then the ground drops out and you're looking down at this giant open space, which is could be the chasm of failure, that's usually when you come up with your best ideas,
yeah.
Don't you think?
We loved working on last season. We had a blast. And so it was like when it was over with, we were happy with the way everything went with the season, but you know, HBO, so we had another show that we wanted to pitch to HBO to go kind of follow Eastbound up with. And they were like, we really want you guys to do one more season of this. Is there anybody can talk you into it? And Jody and I are both kind of like, you know, if we couldn't have Mixon, I don't think we would be able to come up with anything. It feels like he would just be a caricature of like what we created before. Like we, you know, we knew that those storylines that would involve Mixon, and we were excited about those storylines. We weren't able to use them, so we were like, well, this could be a way to get to use all that old shit that we didn't get to use.
Yeah, it was total Hollywood how we got her too. I think like HBO had let Ted Danson go to CBS when they had him under contract, so CBS owed them a favor, so they called in a favor.
The gods of Olympus. Yeah. Oh, wow. They took the little figurines off the wall and put them in the arena.
Right. Clash of the Titans reference? Yeah.
That's how it happened.
A good one with Harry Hamlin. Harry Hamlin and Burgess Meredith.
By the gods!
Rawr. Rawr. Monster! No, it's Burgess Meredith.
Burgess Meredith. I'm a chair.
I still really... if you showed someone the original Clash of the Titans today, they'd be like, what the fuck is wrong with you? But I still love it. I mean, even the effects where you can see they're clearly like fighting in front of a projection screen. Right.
Yeah. And it wraps you up in it.
It's like that and like Sinbad and the Eye of the Tiger are those two, which just like the effects are so bad. But because I watched them as a kid, I will never not love them.
No, they're amazing to go back to. I know I have a 2-year-old. I'm trying to like jam movies on him way earlier than I should. So I'm like already downloading like shit like Cloak and Dagger. And he's like, why aren't you getting this? Why aren't you staying?
Come on, son. You love Dabney Coleman, huh? Here, let's put in 9 to 5. Kids love it. So he says, like, you know, what you had to understand about the sociopolitical climate at the time was that it was a very male-dominated, you having to explain all this. I wonder what's going to happen to children of pop culture obsessives like us who, you know, like, my parents just kind of let me find whatever I wanted, but there's so many people I know that are just like, sit down, you have to watch
pushing
this.
It.
You have to watch this.
Yeah.
Like, what's going to happen? What's going to happen to this next generation?
They'll go against it. They won't want to have anything to do with anything that's fun.
We're going to have so many great athletes in this next generation. Yeah. So many strong jocks.
Fuck my parents. I'm getting into sports.
Yeah.
No! I just wanted you to go into stand-up. How could you do this?
Did you, was your background improv and stand-up, you did stand-up, didn't you?
No, I didn't do stand-up. Jody and I met at film school. We went to this school in North Carolina, North Carolina School of the Arts, and we went there for film. So my background was like in screenwriting and directing is what I studied at school there. And we kind of out of necessity, just because we didn't know actors, would just put each other in each other's movies. And that was just like,
absolutely.
That's the start.
What town was that school in?
Winston-Salem, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Ooh.
Very exciting, yeah.
Because I always thought like all like the arts and film stuff happened in Wilmington, North Carolina.
Yeah. Yeah. That's where we shoot our show.
That's where we shoot it.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Dawson's Creek.
You guys are probably pretty familiar with that. A
lot of good stuff going there.
Yeah. That Raleigh-Durham Airport right there.
Yeah. We all love that. The Piedmont Triad. Right. Yeah, the Research Triangle. There's a lot of names that are floating around that area. Yeah.
Do you still have, do you guys still have homes there in that part of the country?
My parents live there.
Your parents live there?
Right there. But
yeah, I got a home back in Virginia where I grew up and try to get back there every now and then. We shot this last season in Wilmington, so we were basically in North Carolina for almost 6 months. So it was great.
Yeah.
You
it's cool.
Do the Zach Galifianakis thing, just buy a farm.
Yeah.
And then just disappear.
And then show back up. I have a kid now.
Yeah.
What? Yeah. He's a dad.
I know. It's the craziest thing. I know, you know, people probably saw Foot Fist Way or, and actually, I thought you were great in This Is the End, too.
Oh,
fucking
thanks a lot.
Fantastic.
Yeah. That was a fun movie, yeah.
And then Tropic Thunder is probably one of my favorite movies of the last 10 years.
But Foot Fist Way, I remember that just being like, it was that like last like rattle of just someone going, I have this tape, or like, you know, I have this thing, those old videos where it's like, you got to see this movie. And I think it was Aziz, like Aziz got it from somebody and was just like, it's like, hey man, you got to watch this, you know? Yeah.
I'm sorry, is that your Aziz?
Hey man, this is delicious. It's a delicious movie. Iron Chef Matsumoto loves this movie.
See, people would have
the
to know that
by LCD sound system, man.
People would have to know that he's a foodie to know that that's.
He'll let them know. But like, yeah, it was just like he came over and like just and it was great. It was just out of nowhere because it was just this like such, you know, funny movie that you didn't know where it came from, and it was like, oh, it was at that time where you didn't. That stopped happening as much, where it's like you would hear about a movie that no one else knew about.
That was our first deal together, and we it went to Sundance in 2006, and then like it didn't get bought right then. So then
through word of mouth, like what you're talking about, was kind of how we got kind of picked up by agents and got the film out there and all that kind of stuff. Yeah, people were passing it around, and all of a sudden we went from like just meeting, we started meeting people like Aziz and Judd and all these kind of cool people. That's how we met Will and Adam.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
And then they distributed, they picked up the movie.
They picked it up, yeah, and got it. We sold it through Paramount, which was like they had just signed a deal with Gary Sanchez. We were the first film they put out.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
And I think very quickly they regretted picking up the film. Like, we had our first experience, the test screening. And they were like, why are they test screening this movie? It's not like we are going to go back and reshoot it.
It's done.
I think it was just still like, they test screened. I think we scored like a 36 or something terrible on it.
It was horrible.
It was great.
We were trying to tell ourselves, like, Boogie Nights scored terribly at test screening.
I have a list of those movies that make you feel better when you
have
bombs.
Yeah. I have a list of, like, a lot of people like that. Like, it's like, well, Rodney Dangerfield didn't make it until you.
There's that. And then I always also call it the first season of Seinfeld syndrome, because we always go, well, you know, first season of Seinfeld.
Yeah. But, you were like Conan O'Brien for like 3 years. Just like,
you know, it just took him a little. It was a slow burn. It was a slow, the word slow burn. Slow. How about a fast burn? Can I just have a fast burn once? Yeah. Would a fast burn be okay? Did you go on Conan or the late show?
We were on Conan, in character as Fred Simmons, and it was that was awesome because of the fact like nobody knew who I was, nobody knew about that movie, and so like as soon as we went on, we like looked at message boards and people were just like, this man's karate school should be taken away from him. he shouldn't be allowed to work with children.
He gets North. I'm ashamed to come from North Carolina.
I think I told Conan, fuck this show, and walked off.
I remember that.
And I told Will to shut his mouth and he's had his time.
He's had his time.
But it's sort of like you said, even though it was just like it was a relatively short period of time or just a handful of years ago, it still is. Now if you see someone do that, you're like, ah, they're doing a bow. That, you know, everyone's so savvy to the idea of that kind of stunt.
It feels like it's like it's crazy how much things changed, but I guess people are just more informed by the internet now. You can't get away with anything, huh?
Back in 2006.
Well, there was like the Yo-Yo Master guy. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
Like, he got away with like, I think like 5 regional television stations before he got picked up.
It's easier to punk the regions because they're like those morning news shows are fucking desperate for programming every morning. They just need to fill time.
Yo-Yo guy, fucking hey, who cares?
Yeah, so you could sneak in there, and if you're relatively sincere, they'll have you on. And they don't catch on to stuff fast.
Yeah.
They try to just let it breathe, like, you know. Conan or someone, like, they would know.
Yeah.
But you totally could have pulled that off.
Should have done the morning show circuit, right?
Who knew?
Well, you fucking blew it, Danny.
Now where did that get you? What are you going to do now? What is it ultimately that you, I mean, is it, obviously, because you write a lot of the stuff that you work on, and is it, do you want to do, what do you want to do ultimately?
Our setup on Eastbound is pretty awesome. I mean, the fact that HBO lets us do whatever we want, you know, we employ our friends, we get to meet, you know, actors we've always wanted to work with and put them in the show. So it's like, I mean, you know, it seems like with HBO, you really get the freedom of that you don't necessarily have in films unless you're making an independent film. And so that's pretty awesome. I mean, I'd like to perform, write, direct, anything, you know, anything to be any part of, you know, making stuff I'm interested in.
Who did we just have on the podcast that worked with someone? I feel like we just had someone on.
Tom Hanks?
Was Tom Hanks? No, we just had someone on the podcast, and they said they auditioned for, I think it might have been Eastbound, and they came in and they said,
it was Ike.
Ike Barinholtz,
and he was going in for Sudeikis' character.
That's why I thought you had an improv background, because Ike said, you know, you go in and then you just kind of start riffing with Danny, and he said, you know, if you can keep up with Danny, then there's probably a good chance that you'd be okay on the show. And Ike is a fucking machine.
He's pretty amazing.
We were really worried when we were casting for that role for Ivan of last season, because we were like, man, if we get an American, it's probably just going to be too silly. So we actually like put out a casting call in Russia to find.
Oh,
and so we have the most amazing auditions of like these like young Russian men who have like they can't even they don't have they have no idea what the show is. They have no idea the tone of it, and it's just like standing next to their washer and dryer, like reading these lines. And after like a day of going through that, we were like, we need to look for America.
We thought we were being real. We're like, man, fuck this Hollywood stuff. We're going non-actors, real rush, and like it's just terrible acting.
Oh, that's why these people don't make movies. Oh, I get it. There was a reason. Do you have any of those tapes?
I'm sure we can dig them up somewhere.
I mean, if you do like a when you do the next season of DVDs, you've got to put some of them. But I think technically you own that. Like if they audition for the show, I think
they belong to us now.
Yeah. Yeah, they do. Yeah.
They own most of Russia now.
Yeah. Then you're gonna make some Russian guy really famous next to his washer and dryer.
That's the saddest detail of that. Just no better place to show.
That was
the cleanest
hiring
area.
From his family. He's saying he's doing chores. He's going no son of mine is going to be actor.
Every audition starts with them turning the camera on and walking back from it.
Father, why do we not just speak in Russian?
I don't know. I don't know Russian.
So would you do when you finish the season of Eastbound, or is it going to wrap up? Like, are you really going to like wrap up the show, or
there definitely is a wrap up to the whole series for sure. At this, I mean, this has a climax for the whole series, and that was one thing that Joe and I wanted to be sure we had before we came back in, because we didn't want to. We were happy with what we did with the first three seasons. We didn't want to like just come back for one more and then suddenly like throw the whole thing off. You know, like we wanted to make sure that this story like lined up with everything we were building, and you know could. You know, even with the ending, we wanted to make sure it was something that if we never came back to this character ever again or did anything with Eastbound ever again, that this would still kind of stand as a whole.
Oh, that's nice. Cool. Yeah. Did you ever watch a show called Sledgehammer?
Oh, yeah. That was back in the... He was like, what was he, a private eye or something? What was Sledgehammer?
Yeah, it was sort of like a cop show satire. And then they had canceled the show. I know we've talked about this in the show before, but they canceled Sledgehammer and then... So they shot this episode where they just were like, fuck it. So they just blew up the Earth. Like, they're just like, this nuclear device gets detonated, and they just fucking blow it up. And then over the summer, they decided to pick the show up again. And so then they had to come back. And basically the way they explained it was like, what you saw last season definitely happens in 10 years. Like they basically just
went back.
They just set the clock back.
Perfect.
Yeah,
the old Lost.
Brilliant structuring. You know,
we were pretty nervous about that coming back for the season. Like we don't just want to like Kenny goes to space or you know, Kenny's out to sea.
We want to start a baseball team on Mars.
Yeah. That idea was pitched. Yeah.
You're fucking out of space.
You know, we always thought the show might get canceled anyway. So, like, each season was designed, like, we had a bigger story in mind, but it was also designed, like, every season it could end and you'd be satisfied, is what we always thought. So, I guess the season, in a way, is like the others, you know, where it does wrap up just for the season, but it also wraps up, like, a bigger story, too.
Well, it is kind of fun when you must feel this way, where when you're getting to do exactly what you want. And there aren't really a lot of snags, and it's like, oh, we're making the shows with our friends, and people seem to like it, and it's fun. You expect at some point someone's going to come in and go, excuse me, I'm with the universe, and you're not allowed to do that. So we're just going to take this away.
You've just been going on for the whole time?
No, shut that down. Shut all this down. Turn off the grid.
Turn off the powers.
Yeah, right? Powers. We're outside. Turn off the sun. Don't let it turn. But the entire time you sort of felt like, I can't believe we get to just do this.
For sure. And it's like, we even wrote the show to like film in Wilmington, North Carolina, because we just like the beach down there, so we would all just get to live at the beach all summer. It's like, everyone's like, why are you shooting in North Carolina in the middle of the summer? You know, it's like, it's much nicer down there for shooting in the wintertime. Like, well, the wintertime is that beachfront house isn't going to do us much good in the middle of the
We have the boogie board.
We have this fucking Maury boogie board here I need to use.
I got a Mach 7 SS. I need some riding.
Do you remember a movie with John Candy and Eugene Levy called Going Berserk? Do you remember that movie?
That sounds familiar, yeah.
It was an early 80s. It was like early 80s movie. It was like, you know, post SCTV. But the movie weirdly starts off with John Candy. Like, he's basically the head of this tribal village. And it doesn't make any sense with the rest of the movie. And it's basically, he starts off and he basically just tells the story that is actually the movie. And the tribal thing never pays off. And later I found out
The only reason that they did that is because they just wanted to go to Bali, so they used movie money to go to Bali. Like, well, we got to shoot something here. So they basically just made the whole story seem like he was telling a tale to this tribe that they never explained why he was the head of it. Just so they could just... The movie money's fun.
It's a lot of it.
Like, who was it? Tom Lennon said, oh, when we were researching... one of the Night at the Museums, we're like, oh, maybe we'll do it in London. So they just sent them. We're like, go to London on us, first class.
We've always heard stories of that. So even on Eastbound, we were like, how can we take advantage of this? Like, how can we go on one of these research trips? And so for the second season, we always knew we were going to go down to Mexico, but HBO wouldn't let us shoot in Mexico. They just thought it was going to be too much of a liability. And so we were like, well, fuck, that was the Mexico idea, so we could live in Cabo for so then we were like, well, the Dominican has a baseball history, and like that's supposed to be kind of cool. So like we like talked them into flying us to the Dominican for 2 weeks and taking some crazy tour of that whole country. Yeah. And the end, we're like, we're not shooting it.
Yeah, it was kind of like, not to like bash on the Dominican Republic.
But if we were shooting in a resort, it would be cool.
Yeah. We were like, we want to see the real Dominican Republic.
So basically, the lesson is every time you're like, we wanted this to be real, and then you're like, don't real that. Sucks.
Yeah, real sucks. Go to the fake Hollywood. It's much safer.
There's a reason people don't do it that way.
Yeah, like the time I went to Jamaica, it's like I was trying to get off the resort. I was like, hey, I want to go see real Jamaica. You don't want to see real Jamaica. Dangerous.
We came out of a bar, and there was just like this older drunk guy just walking down the street with his shirt open and a sawed-off shotgun.
Joe!
And we were kind of like, whoa, that guy's a fucking gun. You know, and they were like, oh, don't bother him. You know, that probably doesn't even work. They just use him to scare people. Yeah, yeah. It's just like,
that's a cop.
They were just trying to do whatever they could to talk us into shooting
that. Look at that.
They had done one of the Fast and Furious is there, and they kept saying that Vin Diesel loves it here. Vin Diesel loves it here.
Yeah, Vin Diesel's a lot bigger than us. He could probably handle the guy with the sawed-off shotgun. We would just be mush.
No, it's fine. Listen, this guy he has a reel. He wants to audition. It's just all of his headshots are him in different outfits. But a shotgun.
He's a priest with a shotgun.
He's reading a book in the library. Yeah. Chef. Throwing a football.
He has a shotgun with the other shotgun.
Well, that's what I mean. You guys have to go through the casting process too, so you must like as a performer now. It's like having people audition for you. It just totally changes your perspective on the whole business.
It's so uncomfortable, and you feel so bad. You feel like, I don't know. I mean, it's just tough. That's a tough thing. You have to go into a room and, you know, do something that you planned on and shit, move your day around so you can make the audition. You just come in, and you're just like, nah, you instantly know they didn't get it. I went to, very few auditions when I was, after I did all the Real Girls with David Greene. There was, a month where I was like, well, maybe I'll try to be an actor. Like, this seems like this could be kind of cool. And I went to, two auditions. One was, for the Onion movie that they were making. And I forget what the other one was. But I was terrible at both of them and just felt so self-conscious when it was done. I was like, man, fuck being an actor. I'm not doing that. That's terrible. And so it's just too much to swallow.
It's the worst experience.
It really is, man. My heart goes out to anybody who has to fucking drive in this town and go somewhere to sit in a room with a bunch of assholes and do their shtick. And then
and basically just dance on
it. Yeah. Sucks.
Yeah. Well, it is. I mean, like the idea of being just an actor, and that's the only thing. It's so terrifying to me because there's so many things have very little to do with you as a person, but that doesn't stop you from taking on all the rejection.
I know,
nonetheless.
With it. And we even Jody and I talk about that. It's like in the audition process too. It's like someone can be great, but we'll kind of know instantly when they come in before they even say anything. If like, nah, it's not what we're picturing.
It's not their fault.
It's nothing they did wrong. And that's why it feels like such a tough game when actually somebody comes in and nails someone. I mean, Steve Little and Katie Mixon were both just through the casting process as
really?
I wasn't. Steve Little, we didn't know him before, and it was really funny because everyone who was auditioning for that role was really kind of putting on the nerd factor, you know? And Steve Little just kind of brought this
He was. I think he was trying to be cool.
I think he was trying to be cool. It's really what won us over. But even for Katie Mixon, you know, it's like that was the hardest role to cast for the pilot. It's like we saw every girl in Los Angeles, and it was like, how do these girls look like what like the girls I went to high school look like that still live in North Carolina are teaching. Like they're all like they have these perfect yoga bodies and like you know, and like Mixon just looked like a real girl to us. She was beautiful, but like she looked like somebody that we knew or somebody that we had grown up with, and we had that was instantly when we saw her, like we knew anybody who has what she is.
Not like an actress playing real who's just like, I'll just throw my hair in a ponytail.
Yeah.
Like,
I'll put on less makeup.
Yeah,
there was a thing that like me and my wife love. We love looking at the extras in your show, just because it's like there was this in the sports sesh, the second episode. There's this like one shot, or it might have been the first episode that you guys showed, but like it was like there's this like one weird like PA guy just doing this weird like, and it's just like, and that's like, there's a bunch of, there's just like the funniest, like, not, I don't want to say funny looking, because that's kind of stunning, but like, there's just like the perfect looking people that you cast for the background, which just makes that world so much fucking rad.
We have a good extras casting, but we're pretty hard on them too. We're like, don't bring us, like, sometimes you'll show up to a movie or something, and it'll be like, just like the best looking people will be behind the cast, and you're like, that sucks. Like, that's not what people look like.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. That was what was so crazy about like just Entourage, and I know that was probably part of their idea of like, it's like, this is the best you can get, but it's just like there's always some, like, I've been to those parties, and then like, so a guy like me should be there, just like confused on how he got there. His friends like is the DJ, so he's like just there for free drinks. Like they never showed like the weird looking guys,
just always checking the phone.
You're never gonna fucking believe where I'm at. It's like I'm in an episode of Entourage.
That was like in that second episode of third season, the one where Will Ferrell shoots the cannon off. The guy that gets killed in that scene, like, that was nothing that was ever written in the script. It was like David Green, like, his babysitter, while he was in North Carolina for his twins, and the lady came over with her husband, and David just saw this guy. I was like, dude, this guy is so fucking funny. We have to just like find something for him. So we put him in this scene where, you know, when Kenny comes to meet Stevie at the car dealership, and Stevie's like washing cars, and this guy was supposed to just kind of harass him at the beginning of the scene, and that was it. The character was done after that. And we just like ended up fucking with this guy so much, and he was so funny that we were like, well, he should be at this dinner at Ashton Chambers' house the next night. So he comes to the dinner, and then he ends up like he had never acted before, but it was so funny because we were just like teeing up, like, you know, why don't you just start telling some crazy story about hunting? And he would go on this run, and then Will would just try to interject to add to it, and the dude would just stop talking and look at Will, just like, shut the fuck up. This is a bad thing right now. Like, he didn't get that he was being part of the scene, that it was like, he was really like, I'm talking, you know, stop.
Don't you have enough?
and then like the next day of shooting was when we were doing the cannon and stuff, and we were like, we should kill him, dude. Wouldn't that be cool? Like, he gets to go on the whole run. There should be a test run. Somebody should get killed. And so like he was definitely disappointed. He was like, I die? I can't come back? Or like, dude, you were supposed to just be in the car dealership. Like, you have a whole fucking arc now.
You live here. You're not an actor. You were never going to be an actor.
We can't take you with us. You got to stay behind. You got to find your own way.
Staff. Come on, guys. Where are we going? So I come back as a ghost?
No, I don't think so.
But that's sort of kind of what you're going for, is that feel of like real but not, you know. Yeah. Which is it's a very tough thing to engineer that.
Yeah.
Because real is, I mean, it's, I don't know, like that's sort of like American movie sort of a thing.
Yeah, you know, I think the guys who did FUBAR kind of like did a good job of. Do you ever see FUBAR, the sequel of FUBAR, Balls to the Wall? Have you guys seen those?
I've seen FUBAR, not Balls to the Wall.
You got to see the fucking sequel. It's like, it's insane.
Really?
But it's just like they do a good job of just like that fine line of just like, I've been to Canada, I've met a dude exactly like that. And just all, like, there's the main guys who are doing kind of bigger characters, but like, everyone that get around those people are playing it so real, and they're not like gorgeous, and they're just like just people, and they're just pulling it off, and like it just adds to the like the reality of an entire situation.
Do you think the fact that you didn't really set out to be an actor was helpful because you're not really super in your head about it?
I think it definitely was yeah, exactly, because you're not like thinking about like, oh, I need to land this kind of role next or this kind of. I mean, I just basically look around to Jody and stuff, just like, this is hilarious that this has gone on this far. No one has shut this down yet.
You guys still in here? I told you to get out of here. I turned everything off.
Remember when I came in and I said, turn that off? You didn't turn it off.
So are you done shooting? Is everything all done?
We're done shooting. We're editing now. Yeah, we're editing the last two episodes now. So we're going to be done like in 3 weeks,
I guess. Yeah, we're almost done. Yeah.
Do you like the process? Or does it seem daunting? I mean, because you guys are involved in all of it.
Every frame of it. You know, it's great. It takes a lot of time, you know, for sure. It's like you don't get to do anything else when you're doing it. I mean, it's like it's immersive. You got to, you know, be a part of every deal. But it's about a year. And I like writing to production as opposed to writing for development, you know, where it's like you're writing shit that you know in 4 months people are going to have to say and you're going to have to do it. Where sometimes you write for features, it's like, well, this will be a process that takes like 2 years and then maybe it'll get made.
Yeah, I don't like that either.
But and then you'll forget by the end, like, what were we saying?
Yeah, you don't even like it at the end of those kind of things. You know? It's like, I don't want to make this.
Especially with comedy, because you evolve and you kind of grow up and, you know, you probably shouldn't really love stuff you wrote 2 years ago.
Right, yeah.
Too much. You know? Right. You should
appreciate it, but not be like, it's like, man, I'm not doing it as good as those.
Yep, that's as best. That's as good as I'll ever get. Yeah. Oh, no. So, what are you guys? What are you looking to do next? Are you going to do something else for HBO?
Yeah, we saw the HBO show. It's kind of a 3-part show that's set in the world of high school, and they've agreed to kind of. It all shoots at one time, so they've agreed to kind of pick up. I don't want to give too many details away, but they've agreed to like pick up all the shows at once. So we're going to be making like kind of a mini series.
It's going to be an 18-part show, but like they've agreed to like do the whole thing and not just like, well, we'll see how the first six go.
Oh, fucking, that's great!
Oh, yeah. That's fantastic. Yeah. Yeah. So you know it's going to start on episode one and end on episode 18.
Yeah, yeah.
That's it.
And you know the complete story. And that's how you pitch it. Yeah. See, that's how TV should work.
Well,
it's like people should have like, and then this is how it all wraps up. Well, that's great. Instead of just keep it going.
I think it is now. I mean, I think, you know, between HBO Go and Netflix and, you know, they're really starting to understand like, well, people just want to experience stuff all at once. So let's just make it and then just put it out there.
I don't think it's effective. It's all at once. I think it's like the idea that people want to see a conclusion to things. You know, people want to see a story as opposed to just... You know, life is every day. You don't need a show to be every day.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah.
I think it's just everything should have like a nice conclusion in it.
But HBO is interesting because it's not, I mean, you know, obviously their subscriber base is important, but it's not like they don't necessarily have to worry about every rating point the same way that a network does, a TV, you know, like a main network, broadcast network does, because then those people have to go to advertisers and be like, oh, sorry, these numbers of HBO's like, well, fuck, you're already on board, so...
Yeah. You can just melt down those Emmys and sell that gold.
Eastbound's secret is we bring in a lot of HBO Go views and on-demand views, which we... more than their other shows, so for some reason our ratings aren't that high, but because of the on-demand viewings, they keep us on their network.
What's the what about the audience? It's like, I know like a lot of like you know, people I know all love the show, but is there a certain aspect of the audience that might not find the characters and situations like as ironic?
We always say this, that there's like two types of fans. There's like the one type that totally gets the joke and, you know, appreciates it on that level, and then there's the other type who comes up like, man, I'm fucking like Kenny Powers.
Oh, you're a piece of shit too.
I'm racist too.
Inspired me to be so much more racist than I normally am.
Oh, no. It's not a manifesto. It's a... Oh, no.
Yeah, you can't control who's going to like your thing and why they're going to like, or like what they're going
to latch onto. They usually touch Danny and grab him on the street.
I don't know if you want to drink with me or fuck me. I don't know what. It's a lot of tough grabbing. Yeah.
Hey, Danny, there's sure a lot of black people on here. What are you saying? Don't. No. Please. Don't. Like, because then you must be torn as an artist. You're like, thank you. But please.
Keckner says he has to deal with that a lot.
Oh, really?
Dave Keckner says it's like he'll have like fans that go like, it's like, hey, we really like your stuff. It's a very funny. He's like, oh, well, thank you. And then he'll walk another block and be a guy like, fucking champ, yeah. And it's just like, it'd be real aggressive. And
I know, and then he must be like, Jesus.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I'm sure, you know, I think Belushi got that a lot.
Of
just like the sort of, you know, he just resonated, because of Bluto, he just resonated with all these people that...
weren't necessarily, you know, yeah. the audience.
And David Tell talked about that a lot, too, like at the height of doing Insomniac, where just he would go and a guy would be like, hey, man, I want to buy you a shot. He's like, okay, only if you buy all of my friends a shot. And he, like, most guys would go, oh, never mind. You know, I'm a broke piece of shit. But like he says, every once in a while, someone would go, yeah, I'll buy all five of your friends shots just so I can buy you one. Mm-hmm. And he's like, all right, and then I would do it.
That's a good move. I usually just take the shot. Wasted.
Did you guys want anything? Sorry, guys.
That's a good move.
Do you go a lot of? Do you go to a lot of the conventions, the Comic Cons?
I have always liked to promote things and stuff. I haven't ever really been as just a fan, but honestly, wasn't. I didn't even know about them until I went to. I guess I'm trying to think what the first one I went for, if it was like Pineapple Express maybe. But that's the first time I'd ever been to Comic-Con. It was the shit. It was had so much fun there. It was great.
Yeah. It's a good time. What's your sphere of influence? Are you a sports guy or are you like
a... Not really a sport. I mean, Jody and I didn't know anything about baseball or anything when we wrote the show. I mean, it was kind of like a profession that we just kind of pulled out of thin air. That we were just like, well, what would be the most unlikely guy to like be teaching gym at a, you know, and we just kind of, you know, we pulled out baseball. But we thought so little about it that it wasn't even until like a few days before we started shooting the pilot that we both, I was like, fuck, dude, I don't even know how to throw a baseball, dude. I'm going to have to do this in the shot, dude. Like, well, maybe we should get someone to teach you. And then it's like, we brought the guy in. He's like, how many days till you guys shoot? And we're like, well, about a week. He's like, you guys are fucked. So we just learned, you know, to shoot all the baseball stuff very close.
just your arm is throwing.
Yeah.
Out.
Yeah.
So what kind of stuff influenced you?
Just movies, I guess. I mean, that's kind of, we went to film school together. So, you know, I guess we always kind of, we never even really wanted to do comedy. It was just kind of like Foot Fist Way happened to be, we came up with a funny idea with that. And that kind of started us on a comedy path. Yeah, just kind of like, I don't know, shared love of like 70s films and stuff like that. You know?
Yeah, and with all the stuff that we've done there, like Foot Fist or Eastbound, it's like we sort of don't approach them like they're comedies. We kind of approach them as if they're dramas, and like, you know, the more serious the character takes it, kind of the funnier it becomes. And so even with how we structure our seasons and stuff, we never like really think about the structure of like the button joke or any of that sort of stuff.
We
really kind of just try to arc it out, like, you know, to make sure the dramatic beats are there, and then we'll just improv the jokes, and we'll make sure that we have, you know, a good enough foundation on the page, but we don't ever, like, get into any, like, heated arguments about whose joke stays in or goes. It just, you know, you just end up shooting it and just saying 50 jokes and then figuring out which one is too much or which one's not enough.
And a lot of comedy guys that we know are always talking about how many jokes to get in per minute and stuff, and we don't usually think about that. Like, it's really just like a drama with funny lines in there.
That's what I felt about.
We try to take out punchlines too.
It works. I think the really cool thing about all your stuff, like even like Observer Report or Eastbound or Foot Fist Way, is that it's just like it's the story of like a horrible person, and like it's like people are used to when they're watching a movie, it's like they need a protagonist, like they feel the need to cheer for somebody, and you guys just show them that you can't cheer for the main guy. It's like and you dare people to. It's like oh, you kind of starting to like him, and then you do something horrible, and you're like, oh, what are you gonna do now? It kind of challenges people's like idea of like what they do when they watch movies, which is like they connect with someone in the film, and then they go, I'm that guy, I'm gonna. You know, that person maybe date rape somebody. Like, you know, maybe not.
Well, but I do think that I think with having kind of like the shithead protagonist is that people really do identify with that, because they definitely see shades of like
of their own behavior.
Yeah, I get that. You know, even if they're not the whole Kenny Powers package, there still might be things that are like, oh yeah.
Shades of Draper.
But you know, when you think about what were protagonists were like even 20 years ago, you wouldn't have really dared to have the main character of your thing be super shitty.
Yeah.
And now I feel like it's like as a culture, you know, with like Breaking Bad or Mad Men or even, you know, a lot of the popular shows, like there is something like the main character, they really do just constantly dare you, like, I dare you to like this guy.
And that was kind of an answer to some ways. Like, when I had sold a few screenplays before we made Foot Fist Way, and like nothing got made, but the like in a way, Foot Fist Way and Eastbound, these things, they were kind of an answer to like the notes we would constantly get on scripts from development, that the character has to be likable, that this and this has to happen by this page or that page. And, you know, for us, that was kind of what was cool about Eastbound is we always have approached every season as if it is just one, like, long movie. And I just don't really think we'd be able to go into a studio and have someone greenlight like a four-hour dark comedy, you know. But with TV, you're able to kind of bite off that kind of story. You don't have to – we've talked about Eastbound if it was a movie. It's like, I just don't think it would work. I think it would be too predictable of what benchmarks have to be hit. You know, it's like, all right, well, at this point you will like him, and at this point you won't. And when you can have those other episodes, you can take these like detours and go spend more time with other characters. And yeah. The format of it just felt a little bit more like it hadn't been traveled as much as, you know, just a conventional 90-minute comedy and, you know, in the feature world.
Yeah. Well, yeah, you can take the journey with the character too. And you can get to know him better, and the movie thing still, you know, like it's hard. It's so hard to surprise people in with movies anymore, especially with comedy, because, you know, it's like there's so much stuff out there. How do you keep surprising people with jokes? I'm like, well, I guess it's probably easier if you can just let it breathe a little bit more.
And really take, or you gotta trick them. Like, you know, one of the funniest comedies come out like last year was Cabin in the Woods. Which wasn't really a comedy; it didn't set out to be, but it was. Mm-hmm. You know, you gotta kind of go around the bend to actually surprise people comedically, it seems.
Are there other genres you guys want to tackle? Would you guys do like horror or sci-fi or?
Yeah,
I would. I would be up for any genre. I mean, I really
snuff.
Yeah, snuff. Yeah, snuff. We actually have a few of those. Yeah. We made them when we were kids, though, so they're on VHS. Yeah. They haven't held up very well.
Then that's where you go find the Russian guy with the
water. Oh, he's snuff film. Oh, well, I'll be right back.
Yeah. Like, you just, like, if the camera.
Clean washer, dryer combo.
If the camera just tilts up a little bit, you see in the washing machine there's just a hand. Yeah. just see a little glimpse. But what is it? What is it about? You know, when you kind of lock onto a character, do you like just trying to find all the nooks and crannies of that character and just figuring out how to open them up? Like, when you, not even just for your character, but for other characters, how much do you like to explore?
Yeah, I mean, I think like with Eastbound, you know, Danny mentioned that we don't know anything about baseball. But what was cool about it is that he's Kenny Powers is essentially like a modern day hero, and that kind of idea gave us kind of free range to, like, I don't know, it gave it some kind of context that we could like kind of do our thing, make the jokes we want to make, say what we want to say about, you know, kind of human interaction, that kind of stuff. But there was kind of this like broader platform that kind of worked. So we were able to kind of wrap our heads around that and say, okay, there's like, that's a jumping off point, the fact that he was a baseball player, that like kind of lets us kind of work in between all that to make jokes and that kind of stuff.
You know? Yeah, we feel like Kenny is like his whole education just like comes from like cable television, and so it's like with every like human situation he's in, we're always approaching like, what movie does Kenny think he's in? Right.
Well, that's like we're friends with the guy who made Black Dynamite. And you know, and their approach was that they had sort of a similar kind of meta approach where they said, you know, they weren't performers as themselves making the movie. They were like 70s sports stars who were then making that movie.
The guy playing Black Dynamite was a football player.
It's like, he was like, oh, yeah,
that's,
you know.
Brilliant.
He played the director, like, he's all, my character on set was, I was like this old Jewish guy just trying to make money by directing a blaxploitation. And so that's how they would interact with each other.
That's a real fun way to do it.
That should have been like just a fucking extra on the DVD. It was that. Movie. It was like, not Black Dynamite.
Well, I would love to see you guys do something in horror. I think that'd be really fun. And again, Tropic Thunder, fucking, I had the experience of seeing Tropic Thunder in Los Angeles with an LA crowd, and then when I went to visit my dad in Memphis, I saw it with the Southern crowd, and it was so funny to see, like, the laughs were in completely different places.
It's nuts how divided the world is in comedy that way. I mean, you can see something in a city and it plays one way, and in a small town, it's totally different.
Well, every one of those industry jokes where they were making fun of, like, how movies get made, or trailers, or just like like genre films, or just the way that productions like how a production works. Totally lost on the Southern crowd, but then all of the other stuff, just like the way you guys interacting and you just blowing shit up, like they loved it. didn't I tell you my dad thought that the booty quake thing at the beginning, booty quake,
booty sweat.
They thought it was a real commercial.
Yeah. Well, it's because it's like, you know, when we go to see movies, we go to theaters where they like dare not show commercials, but the rest of the country has probably five like commercials for like Coke and fucking, you know, energy drinks and all that shit. So it's like, it probably was more seamless in theaters like that, where it was like actual commercials and then those commercials.
Yeah.
So it's probably more believable there.
Not every city has an arc light, you guys.
What are you talking about? Pasadena, Sherman Oaks, Hollywood. and my favorite city, beach cities.
All the majors.
would you guys want to make a really big budget film, or do you feel like having too much money to make something or too much responsibility is just that kind of ruins the process for you?
I wouldn't be opposed to it, but I feel like there comes a certain like level of responsibility when you take a studio like a ton of the studio's money.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like me and David Green learned a lot on Your Highness when we like try to make a movie that we would have liked when we were 13 years old, and we spend a bunch of the studio's money and just make a fucking 1.5 hour dick joke and Monsters of Mantle.
I really like Your Highness.
I think it was just like no one really got what me and David were like. We were like, well, we made a movie that kids would just sneak into, or that you would stay up late at night and watch on cable. And so he was like, but we need them to pay money to go see the movie.
So you don't get paid when they sneak in?
Ah, shit.
Yeah, Your Highness was great because it did seem like a long time that anyone tried to tackle like a comedy fantasy. Because like, you know, Princess Bride, and that was like, that was a nice movie. It was like, but like, there was so many things to pull from, like Willow, Princess Bride, and Labyrinth, and all that shit. And like, I thought it was a lot of fun.
Well, I'm glad you liked it. But it's like with that, you know, it's fun, obviously, to walk onto a set like that where there's like real money being spent, and you're seeing all the stuff you wrote like being brought to life. But if you want to do something a little off or anything, it's like, you know, that's where the process can get a little more painful. You know, when you go to screenings and you get notes from test screenings that you're like, fuck, you know, like we have to change all the stuff I like just to satisfy like these idiots who didn't really get it anyway. And you end up with something that you're kind of half in, half not. I don't know. There's something to be said for flying under the radar and like making as little of an imprint as you can. And then it's all kind of a win after that.
Yeah. The test screening in Pacoima didn't like the color orange. So can you just take anything orange out of the
movie? We can do that.
So we're going to Pacoima's having.
So I know we said there was no more money in the budget, but we're going to give you $10 million more to go in and do this. Because I remember working on a movie once where we didn't have – it was one of the Rob Zombie movies where they just gave him like a little bit of money to make the movie. And they were like, okay, we're going to double your budget just to go reshoot the ending. And they were too like almost like the ending didn't even – it was a whole – like the production value was insane. But then, of course, it's that much more – like when you take more money
–
it comes with a price of like, now we're really going to be paying attention to what you're doing.
Yeah. I think when you get to a certain level, it's probably cool to do like a big, you got to imagine Nolan, they were probably like on the third Batman. We're like, yeah, man, we trust you, you know? But I think like at this point it'd be work for hire kind of stuff where, you know, you're definitely, you know, under somebody's thumb, you know, when you do it.
Well, I feel like I had the point of view of a lot of people where I would go, well, why wouldn't a studio just give you, like, why don't they just crank out, like, $5 million, comedies? Like, even if they were, sci-fi, or like, effects are good, like, why not just make really inexpensive? That seems so logical to me. And then you realize, like, yeah, but if you're getting that much money, then it's really $35 million because then they're going to spend $20 or $30 million marketing it. So then at that point, it's like a $35 million movie. And then a $35 million movie,
changes the rules on what they're, you know, like they don't just give you $5 million and you run off and then that's it.
No. Yeah.
And then people go see it. Like shit has to get marketed.
But someone's got to pay for those AV Club banner ads.
But there's this weird, there's this weird budget dead zone in film, I think, between like $30 million and like $200 million, where it's, they don't, it's not in that in between zone. It's not quite enough to be enticing to the upper levels because they're not going to make $1 billion potentially. Man. But then it's also too much for a lower budget. So
yeah. I once pitched a show to HBO and like they responded with like it's too small. Like it's like they have like a they definitely have a top, but like there was like a bottom too, and like we didn't reach the bottom of like the scale of the
show. So it's about a Russian guy in a laundry room?
Yes. He's
it's too small.
Too small. No, it's a washer dryer combo.
No. Oh, wait a minute. Okay, what is the cubic size of the
I don't know.
Not big enough.
I don't know.
Because the character wouldn't know. That is kind of funny to hear that something is too small, because you would logically be like, no, that means you spend less money.
Yes,
but
yeah.
these companies have budgets, and they have to, if they don't spend money, then sometimes their parent companies take away their allotment because they're not spending it.
Yeah.
But then so much money gets wasted.
Yeah.
But you guys made Foot Fist for like $80,000, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, those credit cards on that one.
Holy shit.
$80,000 and a lot of favors?
Yeah. Well, yeah, we, like Danny was saying, we went to School of the Arts. So we went to that school, and basically they let us use their senior class. Like just all these kids who were like still in film school at the time came and lived. My dad owned some small apartments, and it just so happened that a lot of people were moving out of the apartments by the time production rolled around. So all those kids just like stayed in Concord and lived in those apartments. And
oh, wow.
We paid them all. Everybody on the crew got $200 a week. I remember that.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
Yeah. It didn't matter if you were the DP or whatever. Yeah.
Well, that was such a good feeling when we finished that movie. I mean, it's been a better feeling than anything I've ever been on, you know, where you have gotten paid money to do it. I mean, yeah, when you're just doing something that's on your own and there's no expectations on it and there's no rules about it, they're really, it's kind of hard to really beat that. And no. I think because we have a taste of that, it kind of makes us a little reluctant whenever you do, if you do have the opportunity to kind of step up and have to suddenly play by somebody else's rules. It's just a little, you know, kind of takes a little of the fun out of it.
Yeah.
But I also think that that is like, you know, a movie like that for $80,000, like that's also part of the subgenre of the movie. Like you, it, if you had $100 million to make that movie, it wouldn't have been the same movie, yeah, even if you did it shot for shot exactly the way it was. You kind of need it to be a little gritty and a little dirty so that it fits the tone of the movie.
We actually thought about that like when we were making it. We were like, all right, there's no way this is going to be like a big budget movie. It's probably going to look bad. It's going to be this and that. So we were like, all right, let's just make it rough. And even if you notice in that movie, all the music hard cuts, like there's never once where it fades out. It always just cuts off right in the middle. And we were like, all right, it's just going to be rough. And we're going to, it's almost like a punk band's first album that has all the hisses on the tape and stuff, where you kind of like it because of that.
Yeah. Lo-fi.
Well, we're about at our hour. That was an hour, you guys.
That
flew by.
Yeah. It just flies by.
Wow. Speak yourselves.
I'm sweating.
But Eastbound's it started in September, right? It was like you're like two or three episodes in at this point.
Second episode was just this past.
So and how many episodes total are the eight episodes for the last season? Well, congratulations on this really is, you guys kind of are the dream and the idol of a young filmmaker, performer who's like, I just want to make something. Like, well, just go fucking make it.
Yeah.
Just make it, and then, you know, and then people will find it. So congratulations. And
thank you.
Thank you guys for having us on. We appreciate it.
Thanks for coming on.
Thanks, guys.
Anytime you want. When HBO picks up season 5.
Yeah.
Kenny in space.
You heard it here first.
When he starts the Martian Marauders team. Then you'll come back. All right. Thanks, guys.
Cool. Thank you.
Enjoy your burrito.
I wanted to ask you about who chooses the music for that stuff. I know this seems like it's still part of the interview, but
when it first started, we used to pick it all ourselves, and then now we have a couple of our buddies working for us, and this guy DeVoyer too.
It's really,
we kind of ran out of all our music after the first couple seasons.
I remember because even like in Observer Report, you had like really good soundtrack in that. Oh. Yeah, there was like a, what was that band? Had the lightsaber cocksucking blues song.
Oh, McCluskey.
Yeah, and I remember like
favorites. I saw those guys in their last before they broke up.
Oh, at the Troubadour?
Yeah.
I saw like sometime that year, like at the Echo.
Yeah. They're really good.
Yeah, right? Fucking great.
His new band's not as good.
I kind of, this is actually, we're still podcasting, I guess, apparently, but.
Oh, sorry. No. Let me get back into my character. Fuck you, Chris. You guys are the best.
Do that dick thing you guys do.
Shit, they call me talking about McCluskey.
No, I was just thinking about that. I don't know why. But the idea that if you had been like comedy performers, then that first season of your show would have been the culmination of like all the jokes you had written up to that point. And then for season two, you'd have been like, what the fuck? But coming from the filmmaker side, the process must have just been like, okay, well, that's the story we were telling now. Now let's just go write this part of the story.
Yeah, pretty much so. I mean, we joked around. We didn't think we would get past the pilot, let alone once we got past a first season. We really didn't think we would get picked up for a second season. And we kind of joked around. We're like, well, if we do get picked up for a second season, it shouldn't be anything the same. We should go to Mexico and just have a whole new cast and do that. And when they picked it up, Jody and I were just like, they're like, what's the season about? I'm like, well, he goes to Mexico, and it's all new people, and none of the old people will be on the show I've ever seen. And we tried to write a version of it where he didn't go to Mexico, and it just felt lame. It was like, we just wrote this last season. Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool.
Shit.
All right. Cool. Thanks, guys. Cool.
Off to work.
Thanks, guys. Appreciate it.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
I feel like I was blindsided.
Because it's a competition show.
From the producers of Jury Duty and The Bachelor.
We have scoured the earth for the 14 greatest reality contestants that were available during our production window.
Comes a reality competition show about reality competition shows.
Nobody has dared to find out who is the actual best at just being on a reality show. I'm your host, comedian Daniel Tosh.
Is win or go home.
Each episode, our contestants will face new challenges. They will test their strength and lack of life skills for a chance to win $200
million.
$200,000.
Prepare, because it's about to be ugly crying.
Lots of fighting.
Tayshia, I have to defend myself.
Celebrating 25 years of reality TV with your favorites.
I have diarrhea. You cannot do this to me.
What in gay hell have I got myself into?
The GOAT. Stream free on Amazon Freevee or Prime Video.